Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. We do hope you enjoyed our previous episode on the mysterious, not so mysterious story of the Mary Celeste. Why do we hope you enjoyed it? Because this story is also about the ocean and ships and unfortunate things occurring related to those two. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hi, I'm Noel. Yeah, we're continuing a bit of a nautical theme here. We're doing themed episodes in 2020. That's a promise.
Yeah, we're getting it together.
That's definitely going to happen.
We're going to get to the rest of those states that we never covered.
Right.
We might do that Nixon episode, assuming super producer Casey Pegram lets us. It's a little tough sell.
Can I do a little disclaimer here at the top of the show? Not a disclaimer.
Yeah, disclaim.
I don't know, whatever. Exclamation, perhaps.
Exclaim.
I don't know the order of the 12 days of Christmas.
Does this bother you?
It bothers me, Ben, because my name is Noel, often mispronounced as Noel. It is a Christmassy name. I should be a Christmas expert. And on that episode, I'm going to blame the Nog. The very strong Nog. I kind of sounded like a blithering idiot when it comes to the chronology of the 12 days of Christmas. Am I really bothered by it? Did I lose sleep over the holidays? Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I did think it was weird because you said, I'm going to quiz myself and this will be fun. And I didn't know what Casey and I were supposed to do, but
right.
We did try to help you. It was just weird because it was like a little bit of, I think, you doing your own thing.
Well, it was a little bit of me trying to flex my Christmas chops, which apparently are non-existent.
I was impressed you just remembered what the gifts were.
Oh,
I mean,
thanks,
the
man.
Order doesn't really, whatever.
No, like, the thing that I got so fundamentally wrong is I claimed that they do not go in chronological order. And that is just absolutely false. There's, you know, the first day is one thing. The second day you get two things. Third day you get three things.
Oh, so there's not like five on the third day or something like that?
No, the fifth day you get five golden rings.
Okay. Well, that would probably bother me if I made that mistake.
I made this claim that they were not chronological. That they were willy-nilly, and that's just not the case. So now I've got it off my chest. I feel so much better. So thank you guys for indulging me in that.
I like that we're doing things out of order again because this comes out second, but we're talking about the episode that came before.
Yeah, but that's okay.
That's our tradition.
It's a new tradition.
It is.
Casey on the case.
Well, I'm glad you feel better, Noel. Hopefully it'll also make you feel better to know that I think you're the only one who was upset about that. I think everybody was fine. It was endearing.
Reports of my upsettedness have been much exaggerated by myself.
Oh, okay. I suspected as much. Have you guys ever been in a accident of any sort, like a vehicular accident? I mean, not like a accidental switcheroo of a name or something like that, but like a car accident. That would be the most common for people in the U.S., right? Or a bicycle accident. Do you have any stories about that?
Yeah, I once had a bird scooter accident. And I jacked my wrist up pretty bad for quite a few months. I've been in a couple fender benders in cars, but that's about it. The bird scooter was the most traumatic by far, though.
The bird scooters are also leaving the city.
Thank God.
Yeah, they are.
What about the Lyft scooters?
I think all of the scooters of that variety.
You're kidding.
That's the rumor.
What a coup.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it works out. Probably because of some of the things you've mentioned, you know? And I know you're a careful scooterist.
I try to be.
Casey, what about you? Do you have any accidents?
Nothing too serious. Just a few times, like minor fender benders, kind of getting like tapped in the bumper at a stoplight or something. But thankfully, nothing too drastic.
Well, guys, now I feel a little bit awkward because I have been in tons of accidents and tons of near misses. I was almost in a plane crash, by which I mean I was in a plane that almost crashed. I was in a school bus that almost went careening off a cliff and did actually get some air on the front right tire. I have been in numerous car accidents, numerous bike accidents. I have not yet been in a boating or maritime accident. And I think when we're talking off air, none of us have been, right? Casey had my favorite line that one.
Yeah, I was asking myself, have I been on a ship? Have I been on a boat? Because I really wasn't sure. I know I've been on some ferries, and I've been on some like small boats, like, you know, Lake Lanier scale kind of stuff, just like 4 or 5 people kind of thing. But I don't think I've ever been on like a big ship, like a cruise ship kind of thing. But I did have to kind of ask myself that. I didn't really know offhand.
Wait, have you ever taken like a tour of a battleship that was moored, like that was docked?
Yeah, I've done that. I have done that. But I feel like that doesn't count because it's anchored and it's stationary and you're not out on the open water.
I can absolutely say that is the only scenario where I've set foot on a large scale ship.
I think I've walked around a submarine even in that same capacity.
You're a real man of mystery.
It's because when I was a kid, like that was the kind of stuff my dad would always want to do when we were on vacation.
Uh-huh.
Is like go see the boat or whatever. And, you know, it didn't interest me that much. But yeah, I feel like vaguely that I've done some of that stuff.
Bit of a history buff, huh?
Yeah. Well, he's in the Navy, so there you go.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I've had similar experiences. I've been on large boats that haven't wrecked while I was on them. But even if you have been in a wreck or an unfortunate incident on the high seas, you probably haven't had the experience of today's protagonist, Violet Jessop, who has, as Gabe likes to call her, our research associate Gabe likes to call her, the unsinkable stewardess. Consider this, like if the four of us or five of us, you know, the three of us recording, you listening, if we were all on a boat together, let's say through some weird series of circumstances, you ended up on a themed ridiculous history cruise, which I have a tough time saying that with a straight face. But what if we were on this ridiculous history cruise and the cruise ship crashed and not everybody got out, but you survived? Wouldn't you consider yourself very lucky?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you also never go on a boat again?
I don't think I would, no. and maybe there's a reason that I am not a cruise-type person, because it seems kind of like being part of a weird herd that just goes to, like, you know, it's being like in prison, like on the sea, where you have to go eat at a certain time, go play shuffleboard at a certain time. Hey, correct me if I'm wrong, folks, if I'm mischaracterizing what is perhaps a very enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
You know, and the Titanic was meant to be a pleasure cruise. That was the idea. It was very, very high class. Only the best of the best high society folks were able to get a ticket. And Violet Jessop was one of the attendants on that voyage, that doomed voyage.
Right. Violet Constance Jessop enjoyed incredible luck. She had a really stressful existence. She actually survived not one, but three different shipwrecks. She was born in 1887 in Argentina. Her parents were Irish immigrants. And as a child, she unfortunately contracted tuberculosis and was officially diagnosed with just a few months to live. However, obviously, she survived. However, 6 of her 8 siblings died young, and her father also died when she was relatively young, and the family returned to Britain. Her mother became a stewardess for the Royal Mail Line while Violet attended school at a convent, and then her mother's health declined, so Violet gave up school to become a stewardess herself.
Yeah, she followed in her mother's footsteps, joining the Royal Mail Line, and then with White Star, the parent company of the Titanic. But it wasn't easy. She was 21. She didn't really have much experience, any experience at all. And most of the folks that were in this industry were seasoned veterans in their, you know, 30s to early 40s. And she was very green and was trying to get into this industry following in her mother's footsteps. And she was rejected quite a bit.
Yeah, get a little of the sexism here. People who might be her future employers said that her youth and good looks would be disadvantageous, and they were worried this would cause problems with the crew and the passengers. And it is true that over the course of her career, Jessop got at least 3 marriage proposals that we know of while she was working on one ship or another, and one was from a very well-heeled gentleman. So Violet takes this quote-unquote problem into her own hands. She decides to make herself look frumpy. And in this description reminds me of, you know, all those rom-com movies where someone is supposed to be mousy and they're a librarian for, like, the first two-thirds of the movie, but they're clearly a movie star-level attractive person. They just wear they wear like a cardigan and glasses or something.
Well, we were talking about like the reverse of that though, because the trope is like the very the secretly attractive person just doesn't understand her inner beauty, and then you know when she takes off the glasses and lets down the nerdy hair bun or whatever, all of a sudden you know the hot football guy sees her for who she truly is.
Which Jennifer, yeah, Jennifer, you're beautiful.
Exactly. What she's doing here is almost a Mulan style situation where she's trying to pass for unattractive and old, which is really interesting that she would have had to do that, especially knowing what we know about the other side of the sexism that would ultimately become, like, you know, we were talking about Pan Am and, you know, the age of the swinging, you know, sky lounges and attractive stewardesses in miniskirts. Stewardesses, by the way, not an okay term to use
flight
anymore.
Flight attendant,
if you please. That's
right. Or steward. The head steward, I believe.
I think that's probably fine. I think stewardess recalls these sexist days. I was listening to an interview on NPR with someone who's the head of that particular union, and the interviewer asked if that term was okay to use, and she very much was like, no, because it harkens back to these times and then the future times where, you know, that kind of attractive dress was encouraged, if not required.
Mandatory. Mm-hmm. It was mandatory. And they also couldn't be married, and they also had to be below a certain age. Yeah, it got real nasty. I would say, though, what I'm arguing here is that the same way that rom-com tropes, like dressing differently, don't fool the audience, this also clearly did not fool the real-life passengers with whom she interacted, hence the marriage proposals. But it did fool the people she interviewed with because she said, I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm going to try to wear old, out-of-style, ill-fitting clothing. And it worked. She gets hired. She has a brief stint on a Royal Mail Line steamer, the Orinoco. And in 1908, she's hired by the White Star Line. She originally did not want to work for White Star because she didn't like the idea of the North Atlantic run. She had a problem with the weather, and she had heard stories about the passengers. They were notorious for being real pills. But she decided to do it anyway. She worked 17 hours a day. She was paid $2.10 per month.
So after, you know, some struggles in finding a situation that she liked, she ultimately found herself on the RMS Olympic, which was at the time the largest civilian, let's call it passenger liner. She's 23 at the time, and that is also when she would have her very first shipwreck situation.
Right. In 1911, the Olympic collided with the HMS Hawk. And the Hawk was not a passenger liner. It was a ship that was designed to sink other ships by ramming them. Both of the ships had pretty substantial damage. The Olympic had its hull breached below the waterline, but through some miracle, it did not actually sink and was able to make it back to port. Violet survived the shipwreck. She wasn't even injured. Both ships were later repaired, put back into service. So no harm, no foul. A frightening event for sure, but not a fatal one. And as we know, there weren't deaths involved there. There was no fatality crash. But still, for many people, that would be more than enough to put you off of boats, make you a landlubber for life. This was not the case with Violet. A few years later, the White Star Line was looking for a crew to serve the very important people aboard their premier ship, the jewel in their crown, a ship that they, along with all the media, by the way, called unsinkable. And that ship was the Titanic. Violet didn't really want to join the Titanic. But her friends were talking to her, and they were like, you know, Violet, this is going to be a wonderful experience. It's a one-of-a-kind ship. It's unsinkable. Bull, 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 bull. Her friends spoke with echoes and the really dramatic parts. So she said, all right, I'm gonna join up.
It was a big deal. It was an event, you know. It was sort of like the Boeing Dreamliner or something of the time, you know. A lot of fuss being made out of this technological marvel. Everyone who was anyone was going to be on the maiden voyage. It was absolutely a cultural event. And her friends were probably like, you got to be a part of this. It's a big deal. You're going to see so many famous people. It's going to be part of history. You do not want to pass this up. So she didn't really care. I don't think. It didn't seem like from her history to be super drawn to any of this glitz and glamour. She just wanted to work.
Right. Yeah. And we have a little bit of firsthand reporting from her via her memoirs. And we know that she was initially happy. And I would say in no small part, she was surprised by the nature of her life on the ship. She loved that the designer, Thomas Andrews, appeared to have paid attention to the crew's request for better quarters. She said, often during our rounds, we came upon our beloved designer going about unobtrusively with a tired face but satisfied air. He never failed to stop for a cheerful word, his only regret being that we were getting further from home. We all knew the love that he had for that Irish home of his and suspected that he longed to get back to the peace of its atmosphere for a much-needed rest and to forget ship designing for a while. And she also, you know, we learn about her day-to-day on the Titanic. She claims to be friends with notable characters who were on the boat at the same time. We even know some stuff about her roommate. We know that she found solace in walking around on deck at night, taking a little, I guess, nightcap walk to get some of that fresh air. And then we know something a little bit, I would say, ominous. Her roommate brought along a copy of a translated Hebrew prayer that she said an elderly Irish woman had given her, and it was strangely worded. As near as she and her roommate, Elizabeth Leather, could tell, it was supposed to protect her against fire and water. We should mention at this point, Violet was a devout Catholic. She carried a rosary in her apron. She, you know, she was a person given to praying as she deemed it necessary.
Which brings us to the night of that fateful collision, April 14th of 1912, when Violet was kind of dozing off in her bunk. She claims to have not been fully asleep, but kind of just in a drowsy state when that collision with an iceberg took place.
Yeah, yeah. She is ordered up on deck. She says passengers are strolling out calmly. She and her coworkers watch the women and children being put into lifeboats, and then a ship's officer orders them into a boat first just to show some female passengers it's safe. And then as the boat is being lowered, she recalls this officer in question says, here, Miss Jessup, look after this baby, and just hands him a baby. I don't want to be – that's a very intense situation to be in.
Yeah, and the quote from her actually describes it even more intense. It says, and a bundle was dropped onto my lap. That implies, I guess, the boat was being lowered down and somebody just dropped a baby off the edge of the ship into the lifeboat, which would have been a little ways beneath.
I mean, good thing you caught it, Violet. Good catch. So they survive. They're only in the boat for about 8 horrifying hours before they and other survivors are picked up by the Carpathia. And her life was saved entirely because that officer asked her to get in a lifeboat because there were other passengers who didn't speak English and couldn't communicate very well. And seeing her get in the lifeboat would persuade the other people to follow her example. So when they were rescued by the Carpathia, the person that Jessup thought might be the baby's mother found Violet Jessup and took the baby away, literally grabbed it out of her arms and ran off. She says, I was still clutching the baby against my hard cork life belt I was wearing when a woman leaped at me and grabbed the baby and rushed off with it. It appeared that she put it down on the deck of the Titanic while she went off to fetch something. When she came back, the baby had gone. I was too frozen and numb to think it strange that this woman had not stopped to say thank you. And we also don't know if that was really the baby's mother.
That's right.
Or if it was just somebody who had put a child down earlier and just grabbed a baby because they thought it was theirs.
Totally. I mean, this would have been like absolute, you know, mayhem.
Distressing.
So, right. She definitely survived her second pretty catastrophic ship collision.
Yeah. So, again, you would think most other people, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but I feel comfortable saying this. Most other people after big shipwreck number two would probably say, I don't know, maybe I'll get into, you know, like gardening, or maybe I will become an interior designer.
One would think. There's a Gizmodo article about Jessup that has a pretty interesting, almost when you read it, makes it seem a little flippant, where she says, it was only after a little while passed after the wreck that she realized she had left her toothbrush on board, and then she was a little upset about that. That's an odd thing to worry about.
I mean, that's how shock happens, though. If you have ever been in catastrophic situations or seen people in shock, it's easy to find one specific thing and worry about just that. And it doesn't have to even be a traumatic, physically dangerous situation. You can see people freak out at social events like weddings, you know, or funerals. It's a fascinating thing about psychology. And although many people lost their lives and Violet Jessup tragically lost her toothbrush, she found another. And she said, you know what, maybe the sea got me last time, but I didn't sink and I'm not going to let my career sink either. So as we're in the lead up to World War I, she says, I'm going to serve as a nurse on board the Britannic, which was a sister ship of the Titanic operating the Aegean Sea. And the Britannic was a White Star liner that had been converted to a hospital ship during World War I.
It's so interesting that she would not only continue working on ships, but work with the same company. Maybe it was like not fully realized right away what an absolute catastrophic failing the sinking of the Titanic was, you know, that it was, I don't know, what was the post-mortem for the Titanic? Wasn't there a flaw in the design? Because they had this whole, like, these compartments that kept filling up with water. Wasn't there something more to it than, I mean, like, it was,
there's also a lot of human error.
Human error, that's right. I think it was more human error than it was. I think the design was a pretty decent one, but it just failed miserably because of the extent to which the ship was just, like, breached, right? The hull was breached by that very pointy iceberg. She not only does she stay working for the same company, she goes aboard the sister ship of the ship that just sank in a absurdly traumatic fashion. But she seems like a really good person because she's very much just wants to help. Like, she decides she's going to become a nurse and put any of these fears aside so that she can, you know, get back to work and help people. And that's when, in 1916, the Britannic hit a mine that had been planted by one of those infamous German U-boats that were so tricky with their kind of covert operations out there in the oceans. And it was damaged pretty significantly and started to sink. And Violet, this time, wasn't quite as lucky as she was when she was on the Titanic. She didn't get a spot on one of those lifeboats, did she?
No, not at all. We should also, did we mention how long the boat was in action, the Britannic?
Wasn't long.
No, it was less than an hour.
Jeez.
It was a hospital ship during World War I for about 55 minutes, at least in this iteration. And you're right, Noel. Violet did not get on a lifeboat. She jumped overboard. She almost got sucked into the propellers, which would spell certain death. They were sticking up out of the water. They were still running. She hit her head on the ship's keel, and she probably would have died. This was one of her most extreme shipwrecks. However, As luck would have it, passengers of a nearby lifeboat saw her body and were able to pull her in. We have her own words about this experience.
She says, "I leapt into the water but was sucked under the ship's keel, which struck my head. I escaped, but years later, when I went to my doctor because of a lot of headaches, he discovered I had once sustained a fracture of the skull." And she even kind of joked that the only reason she survived was because she had a very thick head of hair, which she characterized as having kind of helped soften the blow a bit. But she wouldn't know for years that she actually fractured her skull hitting her head there. And there's a Mental Floss article about the unsinkable Violet Jessop that mentions something that she has said in an interview where when she abandoned the Titanic and she was so concerned about missing her toothbrush with this one, she really was a big stickler for oral hygiene, it would seem, because she grabbed her toothbrush on the rapidly sinking Britannic, I'm assuming clutching it in her fist.
Yeah.
Do you think she made it? Do you think it like?
I like to think of her pirate style with it in between her teeth, like a knife, but she probably grabbed it or put it in a pocket or
maybe
something on her person.
That's a good point.
But yeah, you know, if you can say anything about Violet Jessop, it's that she got her priorities straight. And also imagine if you're a fervently religious person, a devoutly religious person, then this feels like proof of a higher power, right? It's the third shipwreck that you've survived. The odds are against you.
Right. And, you know, we talked about at the top of the show this idea of her being really, really lucky. You could say that. You could also say that she wasn't particularly lucky. She was in three shipwrecks. She did survive, but
right.
It's almost like, you know, bad luck kind of followed her, and she luckily was able to kind of dodge the blow.
It's a glass half full, half empty.
It absolutely is. But this was finally reason enough for her to seek alternate employment, though,
yes,
right?
But still in the ship business. She left the White Star Line. She went to the Red Star Line. She did. She worked as an attendant on cruises for
several
years.
To be tempting fate going to another star related
right,
company.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Well, I guess after your three shipwrecks, you decide you're going to change at least the color. Luckily, she was never involved in a shipwreck of catastrophic sort again. After World War II, she worked as a clerk for a while, but then she went back to working on Royal Mail ships for a while. And then when she retired at the age of 61, she spent her time gardening and raising chickens. We do know that she got married once in her late 30s, but all we know about the marriage is that she described it as brief and disastrous. She did a lot of interviews. She was interviewed for Woman magazine when the film A Night to Remember was released in 1958, and her home was filled with mementos of her time at sea.
Yeah, and you don't really think of, what's the word I'm looking for, ship attendants? I don't want to use stewardess because we said that was a bad one at the top, but I guess at the time that was what they were called. You don't really think of stewardesses in these days writing very noteworthy memoirs. But if you think about it, she had a complete insider's perspective on the Titanic and everything that took place. In fact, some people think that the character of Lucy in the John Cameron Titanic film was based on Jessop. She also had being in that position on all of these different ships is pretty interesting from a historical perspective, just to talk about the way things happened, not to mention some pretty significant maritime disasters. So she wrote a memoir very soon after retiring at the age of 63, and she wrote quite well by all accounts. Was very articulate and was able to really give a look at life at sea from that vantage point.
And saw a lot of things that the average passenger or the captain wouldn't see, because a cabin attendant moves through all the hierarchies of the ship and is familiar with everything before the curtain and behind it. So we get a little bit of a Downton Abbey vibe, you know, where they have the downstairs people and the upstairs people. And here our tale draws to a close. Is Violet Jessop the only person to survive multiple shipwrecks? Absolutely not. Is she one of the most well-known people to survive multiple shipwrecks? Absolutely. But this made us think off air about other strange, you know, close brushes with death, like the people, I think, Casey, you may have mentioned earlier, people getting struck by lightning multiple times. That happens.
Yeah, there's been a few well-known cases, I guess, of that happening.
And no, contrary to what certain films may have you believe, it does not give you superpowers. I'm also thinking, what would be the weirdest vehicle to wreck? Maybe a blimp nowadays? That'd be a weird one to wreck.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got the Hindenburg. You know, that was a big...
So it's been done.
It's been done.
It's been
done. We need a new one. Maybe a Segway? I've already got the bird scooter thing on
lock. You've got that one. Hot air balloon, maybe, but I feel like those would sort of wreck anyway.
Do you guys remember Balloon Boy?
Who was Balloon Boy?
It was a fake story, but it was reported as real for a while that there's some kid...
Yes!
...who, like, got into a hot air balloon and it took off without his parents. And so they were like, we got to get the kid down. And, you know, there's like news cameras following this hot air balloon just floating around. And turns out the family was in on it. The kid was hiding at home and they just did it for like reality show publicity kind of stuff.
Wow. Terrible parents. Okay. Well, let us know what vehicle we should try to be involved. That sounds weird when I say it that way. Oh, a chronoplans. You know about those?
No.
They're these weird half-boat, half-plane things. E-K-R-A-N-O, plan. Look it up when you have time, folks. It's very strange. I've always wanted to be in one, and if I were driving or piloting it, I would probably wreck it. But this concludes our story. We know that everybody has had these close brushes with disaster, and it can fundamentally alter your worldview. But how would you feel after shipwreck number one? How would you feel about shipwreck number two?
Not great. Yeah, about not either.
Right. And I think here in the studio, at least the three of us are pretty unanimous that at least after shipwreck number two, we would give some serious consideration to staying on land. But, you know, three people, that's a small sample size. Give us your thoughts. We would love to hear from you. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We especially love to recommend our community page, Ridiculous Historians, on Facebook.
Yeah, all you do is have to invoke one or both or the three of our names, and you're in like Flynn, or just say something.
Make me laugh.
Make any of us laugh, or just make a silly reference to a topic on the show, just to let us know that you're not Russian. Bot.
You can also find us in our personal lives on the internet. I am at Ben Bullen on Instagram, and I'm at Ben Bullen HSW on Twitter.
You can find me exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown. Huge thanks to our super producer, Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, research associate extraordinaire, Gabe.
Big, big thanks, of course, to Christopher Hasiotis. Big thanks also to Eves Jeffcoat and Jonathan Strickland, AKA the Quister, who shall be returning soon. I do also want to say, as you know, the three of us travel quite frequently, and I'm a person who travels all the time. I want to say thank you so much to everyone who works in the travel industry, whether you are moving goods from one place to another for people, whether you are working as a flight or cabin attendant, which I could never do, whether you are a pilot, so on. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I do want to say for everybody who is traveling as a passenger, whether on a plane, train, or a boat, or an automobile, please, please just behave yourselves. People get crazy in planes. We should do something about that at some point. As an episode. Or as a society.
Absolutely. Ben, have you ever seen the film Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
I have, yeah.
I recently watched it for the first time, and I found it heartwarming, funny, and just an all-around delight. Casey, how about you?
Oh, yeah, that's a great monologue that we can't quote here.
But, yeah. Yeah, there's one scene that makes it an R-rated movie. It is a very soft PG-13 prior
otherwise,
to this one scene where Steve Martin goes ham on a rental car attendant. And it's one of the best uses of the F-word I have seen in a film, because it actually... They earn it, and it's definitely for shock value, because you don't get anything like that, but he has worked his way up to being this enraged, and it absolutely does feel earned.
Also, Steve Martin is an amazing banjo player. He
One of the best.
One of the best. It's a true story.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.